Welcome to the Tom Dupree Show for our New Year's Day special edition. Joining us, Mike Johnson, Adarsh Meshru on the phone, and our host, Tom Dupree.
So, this is Genesis, and can you turn me up a little bit? I saw either them, or it might have been just when he was Phil Collins at Rupp Arena years ago. And so Phil Collins would stand up behind the band and stand while playing the drums. And, you know, my seat was like directly behind them. You know, they used to do that. But it was a good seat. I mean, it was a great concert because he's an incredible showman. You know, that's just what he does. It wasn't as good as the Rolling Stones, but it was getting as good.
Yeah.
You know,
the neat thing about this kind of era, I mean, you think you've got Phil Collins, Don Henley, kind of the same, yeah. You know, drummer, singer.
Yeah.
But, you know, Genesis, I mean, they're a progressive rock band, you know, kind of in the same vein of Kansas.
Or Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You know, I just saw something, just kind of getting on the music thing. Greg Lake and Ian Anderson playing Father Christmas. It was right before Christmas, of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. And they were a big sound kind of band, you know. Like Yes, sort of like Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you'd had Eric Clapton, who played great, or the Beatles. But they didn't have this bombastic show, you know. It
yeah.
was more like watching a folk singer or
yeah.
something that played good rock guitar. These guys all figured out. I think a lot of them figured it out from Kiss. I swear I do.
Yeah.
You know, and like Kansas, everything. How to put on a big time.
Put on a show.
Bombastic show. So
Ian Anderson, that was Jethro Tull,
yeah,
right?
And he, this was in a church, this other thing I saw about Father Christmas. And it was just, it was Greg Lake playing guitar and singing. So you've lost two members of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. I think the Palmer guy is still alive. But Greg Lake was the one whose vocals you always heard, you know, just like the other Anderson guy in Yes. I can't think of his,
I don't remember
it's
his
not
name.
Ian, but it's John Anderson.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, Roundabout and all those, which is a similar sound vocally to Phil Collins a little bit.
Right.
You know, so that was sort of an era, as you say.
Yeah. It never to be repeated.
No, it won't be. It's just done.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, now we've got Alicia Keys and Adele. Oh, I'm happy. So we have this article that you guys picked. COVID-19 inflation make a mess out of predictions. So it's harder with all the different outliers that are affecting economic progress and performance these days in output, economic output, to make predictions. So I would also say to that I'm not sure the predictors have always been that good to begin with. And now it's just becoming obvious that they're
right.
really not very good. Like you remember, Abby Cohen would always be in the Barron's Roundtable, the Goldman Sachs, and she was right a third to half the time. Sometimes she'd be dead wrong. But anyway, go ahead.
So this is an article by Greg Ipp, and he's pretty good. He's the chief economist for the Wall Street Journal, and he makes some good points in a lot of his articles. But what this one's focusing on is anytime you're coming to a new year, you're going to have predictions on, you know, what the greatest risk is, you know, for the coming year and what you need to be watching. And you look back in time, you know, last year, you know, prime example, who was saying that, you know, COVID or, you know, a pandemic was going to be the biggest, have the biggest impact on the market and the economy. Nobody was, you know, they were saying that it's, you know, weather changes, you know, that's top the list every year, you know, climate change, things like that. You know, starting, you know, this year, you know, it wasn't inflation. So there are all these things that they always talk about, and very seldom are those the actual risks. That's the nature of a risk.
So why do we listen to them?
Exactly. And so that's why you have to be careful as an investor.
And those guys get paid a lot of money.
I know.
You know, I mean, people pay them quite a bit just so they'll have an opinion
right
about everything, you know.
I
wonder what Fauci gets paid. I'm sorry, I shouldn't go. This is not the first hour, so this is the second hour. Go ahead.
In the economy, in when you're investing, you have to have humility and a willingness to always examine.
You have to do that when you're married also.
Yes, you do. You better do that. You better do that if you're married.
Yeah. You may not want to, but anyway.
But humility and know that what hurts a market, is not something that everybody knows about happening, because the market's already essentially taken that into account. What hurts a market is a surprise or something that deviates from what is, acceptable, if you will, in the marketplace at the time. And that's the nature of a surprise.
So let me ask Adarsh, do you think that so the most recent low that was within the last 15 years was March of 2009, when I think the Dow got down to 6,400 and change and that kind of thing. Do you believe that going into that, that bear market, if you will, was based on a surprise, or that it was all kind of baked in?
Well, I'd say if you go back to March of 2000, you know, there was a huge bubble that culminated, the tech bubble that culminated in huge rise that culminated in the tech bubble, rather, which peaked in March of 2000. And since then, the market had never gone back to its high. So the NASDAQ was way below its high. The S&P 500 was still below its high until around January of 2008. So the market, you could argue, was already in a bear market since then. Because if the definition of a bull market, and there are various definitions. One of the definitions is that for a bull market to really be a bull market, it has to exceed the previous high. So back in March of 2000, the S&P hit around 1,400. And it just barely reached that level in 2008. So you could argue that from 2000 to 2008, we were, you know, in an ongoing bear market. Now, there were certain sectors within the market that had started a new bull market. So financial stocks, for example, they were making new highs. Oil and gas was on its way to making new highs. But tech stocks, various consumer stocks, they were still way below where they were in the year 2000. So was your question, was it predictable?
If it was predictable, who predicted it? To whom was it not a surprise, and to whom was it a surprise?
So there were a few people who were predicting it, and their reasons for predicting it were different. So there were people who watched the yield curve. They were predicting that there was going to be a recession because the yield curve in 2006 started inverting. So the Fed started raising short-term rates from basically 25 basis points. They raised it all the way to, or I think it was 1%. I don't know if it went as low as 25. They raised it all the way to 5.25% in 2006. So those who were watching the yield curve were saying that, okay, there is going to be a recession, and the recession would be preceded by the stock market dropping. Then there were people who were watching the Fed watchers. They were saying that the Fed has inflated the housing market by keeping interest rates too low for too long. You know, this is going to lead to not just the housing market collapsing, but it's going to have repercussions in the wider economy. So there were people like Peter Schiff, if you remember, you know, his argument was that the Fed was causing this. And of course, there were also firma bears who've been arguing for bear markets for, you know, since much before then, who've been saying that, you know, because the bull market's been so strong since the early 80s, it was inevitable that at some point, you know, there was going to be a massive drop. Valuations were high relative to where they were in the 80s or even the early 90s. So there were people predicting it. They had different reasons. But what's interesting is all those people who were right at that point, you know, and were right in predicting the bear market, were wrong in predicting the bull market that began, you know, in March of 2000. They were still bearish after that. And since then, you know, as we know, the market has gone on to make new highs.
You mean March of 2009? That was really the low, not March of 2000. March of 2009 is what you mean, right?
Yes, the bull market in March of 2009. So, interestingly, March of 2009 is when the current bull market began. And March of 2000 was when the previous bear market started, when the tech bubble burst.
Yeah. And okay, so the stock market is built basically upon supply and demand. And you have overhead supply. There is no overhead supply right now because that is people that have bought things at a higher price that are waiting for them to come. Well, I guess there is in certain areas like SPACs and things like that, there would be overhead supply there. But there isn't in a lot of the main names because people still hitting new highs and or close to new highs. So you don't have a lot of technical overhead resistance. You know, I don't see I would argue that the predictive class out there has become so politicized on one hand and sort of encumbered by the Fed that they have very little value these days. But I think it's always been that way, and that the market has and will continue to have a mind of its own. Take late 99 when everybody was saying Y2K is coming. It's going to be a disaster. Planes are going to fall out of the sky. All the computers are going to quit working. Yet December of 99, the market continued to rally. It was as if there was a hidden wisdom in the market that ran counter to what all the talking heads were saying. And we see this on a daily basis. You know, when the market is trading right up in your face, there's no consultant or talking head that can, you know, when they have the article the next day in the Wall Street Journal, market higher on oil prices, market higher on Fed comments. No, it's not. It's higher because there were more buyers and sellers. but they want to tie it
right
to something somebody said or did. Well, that's BS. It's higher because we had more buyers. Why did we have more buyers? Some of it could have been the comments, but it could have been a million other reasons. So I don't know. I'm just interested in what y'all think on that.
Well, the algorithms that are running now too, you know, their algorithms are supposed to be, you know, have a better predictive capability. You know, they don't, because it ultimately it's the exact same thing as a human decision making. You're always looking back on history saying, why did this occur? Because this event and this event, you know, an algorithm just looks back at trends that have taken place before. Well, it's never the same exact thing in the market. It's always something different. Even if it smells the same, there's going to be something slightly different about it. And that's the thing about you know, a market meltdown that you've seen is, If everybody knew that it was the exact same as something else that had happened before, you'd be buying because everybody knows that it's cheap. There's always something new to it that you say, well, maybe this time it is different. You know, if it's, you know, mortgage related or, you know, shutdown related, whatever it is, there's that dynamic that makes you pause as an investor and say, this time is different. This thing could go down, stay down. And so the idea that, a lot of times it's people that haven't been through times right. like that. They say, exactly. Well, it's gone down this much. Hey, that's the time to buy. Shoot. You know, that's a great opportunity. It's hard to do in those kinds of environments. So when you're building a portfolio, and, you know, researching the holdings, researching, you know, the areas that you're invested in, you don't do that for when times are good, quite honestly, because you could in an up market, you can almost throw a dart. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Side note: this year has been interesting because.
Yeah, it worked like that.
Well, because if you've thrown a dart, there's a good chance what you hit with that dart has gone down because the indexes are masking a lot of what's gone on underneath the surface.
So I was just thinking about, you know, people having the ability to predict or not. I remember during 07 or 08, Maria Bartiromo was interviewing. What was the Countrywide guy's name? The president of Angelo Mozilla. Mr. Tan, you know, had that uses tan as his table. She says, "Are we going to have a recession?" And he says, "I don't know." Are you kidding me? You know, of course we were going to have one. I mean, even I knew we were, and I'm not him, but. Sometimes it's like, it's just, you know it, you know that this is going to happen. But right now, you know, you don't really know. It's like the market is getting better at correcting excesses of things quickly.
Yes.
That are excessive.
And that's been, it'll be interesting to see how long that trend lasts. Starting last year, you look at how quickly the market dropped in March of last year and how quickly it came back. You had the exact same thing happen in September of this year, December of this year. I mean, you had, you know, the S&P and the Dow drop, you know, 5% plus, the Russell dropped 12% or so in December. And then over the course of what, Adarsh, about four trading days, it had recovered.
Yeah.
And so it's like information flow, which is quicker. It's like the market itself. It's like it's making these
processes
and moves prices quicker now.
More nimble, and more robust. In the way.
So it'll be interesting, but it does seem that the market has gotten faster in the last couple of years on how it reacts to things.
Sorry, Adarsh. We need to wrap things up for this first part of the second hour. If you want a new look at your portfolio going into 2022, give us a call, 859-233-0400. And that is a shameless plug. We will be back with more of the Tom Dupree Show. First show of 2020. I can't even say it. 2022. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more of the Tom Dupree Show. Welcome back to the Tom Dupree Show for the second half of the second hour. Joining us, Mike Johnson, Adarsh Mesher on the phone, and our host, Tom Dupree, and Happy New Year.
So this song came out in 1983. It was right about the time when I was moving to Houston. I moved there in November of 83. I remember the music from that time because it was such a major change in my life. I'd never lived in a big city before. I'd never really been outside of Kentucky. Are you just going to turn it off?
I didn't just turn it off. We pre-recorded it so we could have Adarsh on the phone. We're telling all our secrets.
That's fine. But anyway, so that was a period in time I remember all the music. And there was a song that came out, and I was in New Orleans visiting my cousins, driving over to Houston to go live there. And this song by Yes, Owner of a Lonely Heart, that song came out. And then, like within 6 months of being there, this girl from wherever she was, Bay City, Michigan, who lived in New York, comes out, this movie comes out called Desperately Seeking Susan. And, you know, I was going out with this girl that was from Lexington, that was a member of a certain sorority. I knew some of them. They lived in Houston. She says he wants to go see this movie. And I didn't, you know, hell, I didn't care about going to see the movie. But anyway, so she comes out with this song. And then next thing you know, and then all these groups are coming out, like the Cutting Crew. And, you know, George Michael and Slam or Bam or what?
Wham,
whatever they were called.
We're dating ourselves.
And then this group called Duran Duran. Who else? You know, different people. And then I would kind of was going out with this girl who we went in the middle of it all with all these new groups. Eric Clapton still just boogieing along for what, 50 years now? And so we go see him over at the Summit. Great concert. You know, there are people who come and go, and then there's those who stay.
Right.
And then, let's see, I went to with a bunch of friends. We went to see ZZ Top. They're kind of an enduring factor, especially in Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I did see Billy Gibbons in our office at Rotan Mosley. He was in there investing like about $5 million in a bond issue. I don't know. This is, you got me thinking about all this stuff. It's the end of the year, you know. I mean, what am I supposed to do?
Beginning of the year.
I'm a reminiscer. I think about stuff because I try to think, well, where are we going now? You know.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've been through some stuff. I was going to say another word. But, you know, what do you do going forward? Well, stock pickers are struggling to beat the market. Some 85% of active U.S. stock funds were on pace to underperform the S&P 500. So what does that say? Oh, well, I'll just buy the index. You know, for a happier financial life in 2022, face your money fears. Oh, okay, I'll do that. Lesson of the century, don't underestimate the resilience of the U.S. economy. I have to agree. So, you know, what do we do? Well, it's good to talk about these things. Talk about your fears. You know, talk about all the stuff. This is what we do. We could do a show every day, and we really should, because I think we're really good at this stuff. But, you know, I mean, you know, which one you want to pick? I would go with whatever you want.
I want to talk about the stock pickers one. a couple key points I want to hit on this. So the point that they're making is that 85% of the actively managed mutual funds out there. So that would be your mutual funds that you're seeing in your like your 401k, where you have a fund manager that manages the money.
Yeah, but a lot of those are index funds now.
But they do still have, you know, the growth fund and, you know, value. They'll still have some of those categories.
So they got American funds.
Yeah.
Growth Fund of America.
Exactly.
How are they doing? I mean, I haven't looked at them, but.
It's done well.
Yeah.
It's done
they
well.
They always have.
Yeah. And the reason it's done well is because it's sort of a victim of your own success. You know, they had to buy something with a lot of liquidity. So
but
what
they are brilliant stock pickers.
They've done well.
They are brilliant people.
Yes.
Year in, year out, they're brilliant.
But so when you're we briefly talked about in the last half where the indexes have masked a lot of what's gone on underneath the surface.
Right.
But one key point I want to make on this, you read the headline and you're like, well, why the heck do I even need anybody if I'm just, you know, I can just put it in the S&P 500 index fund? Good point. Here's why. When you look over a long period of time, you have the S&P 500, which is U.S. companies. You have international. You have small cap, mid cap. When you're investing your life savings or you're accumulating your life savings, you're not going to put that in one area of the market, because what you're doing if you put it in just the S&P 500, you're buying Facebook, Amazon, Netflix. I mean, it's market cap weighted. That's what that is weighted towards. You diversify your portfolio, be it in other sectors, individual stocks. You should not have all of your portfolio in just the S&P 500. You need to have bonds, depending on your situation. Let me put that caveat in there. Bonds, preferred stocks, value, growth, small cap, areas of the market where if one doesn't do well, maybe the other one does better. If you had a diversified portfolio, even if it was 100% stock in 2021, you would have underperformed the S&P 500 because small cap underperformed massively. You know, you had coming at the end of 2020, that's when you started having value outperform. You started having more of the cyclical sectors outperform.
So let me, Adarsh, the reason for small cap underperformance, is it because these stocks are less liquid and have less sponsorship, and if something goes away from that, the bid side drops drastically? Or is it because their prospects as businesses declined and made their stock prices decline? Which one do you think it was, or both?
Are you talking about last year or this year?
Recently, the underperformance in things like SPACs and small cap, is it because of lack of liquidity, or is it because of poor business prospects of the underlying companies?
I differentiate between SPACs and small cap.
That's fine. Yeah, let's just talk about small cap that are real businesses.
So, I mean, part of the reason why small caps have underperformed this year is because they had they outperformed big time last year. So I think a lot of it is just digesting the gains of last year. Small caps tend to outperform during the early stage of the business cycle. And if you go back to last year, we obviously had a big recession in the second quarter. And third quarter onwards, the economy started reviving. And that also coincided with the period when small caps outperformed. They outperformed the large caps. Since then, we went through a period where we had massive, you know, GDP growth numbers, third quarter, fourth quarter, even the first quarter of this year. And then the economy, you know, then the question became that, okay, now that we've seen this recovery, is liquidity going to tighten? And once the market started digesting that factor, you know, small caps started underperforming, and larger caps, the safer companies, started outperforming, just because in an environment where liquidity tightens, the economy slows down somewhat, you want to stay with the high quality names. So
right.
Small caps, they continue to do well. It's not that they've really underperformed as such. It's just that they outperformed tremendously last year. If you look at the chart of the Russell 2000 in 2020, around May, June 2020, into early this year, it significantly outperformed everything else. And since then, it's just gone sideways. It's not even gone down. So you could argue that this is just digestion before, you know, the next move up.
So in the business of managing investment money for retirement, in an era of low interest rates, which we're in, you know, we have to look to things other than bonds and fixed income obligations, you know, to fund the payout for retirement over time. If you are not able to produce enough just from dividends and interest, you have to look to other things in order to fund the payouts, and that would be capital appreciation. Now, there's two ways in investing, generally two ways, to get capital appreciation. One is to try to buy stocks or investment products at a price that's below their liquidating value. That's the Ben Graham value approach. Very difficult to do in a bull market, in a market that's been going up for a long time. It's hard to find assets selling below their liquidating value that will be subject to a catalyst anytime soon that will realize their liquidating value, you know, because if that catalyst was forthcoming, then the market would have already recognized it, and the stock would have, or investment product would have come up. So it's tough to find. So then you're looking at momentum, you know, because it's kind of like you're looking for something that's moving up, and it may keep moving up regardless of underlying value. You know, when a bank right. trades at 3x book, well, we know the bank can only be liquidated for book. And let's say that's $10 a share and the stock's at 30. Hey, the rest of it's momentum. You know, and so then now you're betting on this guy to pay this and this. So you're in a quandary as you're managing money. How do we do this? How do we, you know, and this is a lot longer than the 7 minutes we have remaining, but you guys just jump on this.
Yeah, I'll start it, Darsh. let me back into that. What you have to be careful of, first off, is you were talking about dividends and you know, where are you getting the income, what our clients are taking, withdrawals. You have to be very careful not to chase yield, purely yield, in this kind of an environment. Because like you said, if something, if it's overvalued, you know, you use the bank example, 3x book, well, if you see something that's yielding 9-10% on the dividend, or it's a bond that has that kind of a yield, then you have to really stop and say, okay, where is the problem? Is it really a problem? That's you have to be very careful not to chase yield. So back to your question, where do you find things? Right now, it's quality. Quality companies, you know, companies with strong balance sheets that make things that are used.
But they're expensive.
Well, some of them are. Some of them are. Some aren't. You look at some of the dividend paying stocks, you know, large blue chip kind of dividend payers, and they have a PE that's relatively cheap compared to the market. And that's the thing, you have to look relative right. valuation.
But what are their growth prospects? I mean, that's the tough part, you know.
That's right. Yeah, and
look at that.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, this is not an easy deal.
Right. You look at some, and that's the hard thing too when you're looking at value investing. You look at something 5 years ago had a high multiple, but now it's grown into that multiple and beyond. And this is a point you've made in the past, Adarsh. You know, could you make the argument that 5 years ago that was a value? That was a value
like
stock.
Apple,
or you know, a number of things.
So, Adarsh, what do you think about that?
Yes, as far as value goes, I think the definition of so ultimately, what is value? Value is something that is valuable. And it turns out that some of these companies, whether it be companies like Apple, Amazon, Netflix, they do provide real value to our society. And hence, you know, they are the value companies of today. So I think that the definition of value from that point has changed, where it's not just, you know, you look at the book value of a company. Today, the intangibles matter a great deal.
Didn't Warren Buffett kind of roll over on that like 30 years ago and say that he was, or even longer than that, maybe 30 years ago, and said no longer did he only use the Ben Graham definition of value to decide what companies to buy?
Yes, he did. Yes. And Charlie Munger, his partner, had a great influence on him, and he credits him for that. But I think when Ben Graham was picking stocks, you know, around the Depression, even after the Depression, there was a significant information arbitrage, you know, that you could gain by looking over the balance sheet or the income statement of companies. That arbitrage started going away as information became more easily available. So then Buffett realized that in that scenario, now, as you said earlier, there are moments, you know, say if there's a deep bear market like 2008, 2009, when there's tremendous fear, during those moments, you are able to find, you know, companies that are trading below their book value just because of the fear aspect. But in a normal environment, you know, Buffett realized that you may not find a company that looks cheap necessarily, but the product or service that they are offering, you know, is extremely valuable. And that became his definition. So Coca-Cola was a good example where, right. Coke stock didn't look cheap,
30, 40 years ago, and neither did American Express. But he was like, these are companies that are onto something. They're here to stay. They have a moat. So he transitioned. And more recently, there are managers like Bill Nygren, who runs the Oakmark Fund. He famously, and even before him, Bill Miller, who ran the Legg Mason Fund, he started buying Amazon pretty early. Because even though he was a value manager, and Bill Nygren bought Netflix pretty early, and their argument was that, yes, these are not your traditional value investments, but these are companies that are providing value to our society. And even though they look expensive by traditional metrics, they will grow into their valuations and they'll keep growing their business. So
that's the same thing with Walmart. And Walmart 35 years ago, Microsoft 25 years ago, you know, these were companies that always looked expensive, but were always good to buy for a long, long period of time.
Right. And there will come a point where their valuations will matter. So, you know, if Apple starts trading at 50 times PE, for example, despite its value to society, the stock may underperform at that point. So just because, you know, it's a valuable company. So, and that's the tricky part, that valuations do matter, the traditional valuation metrics. But at the same time, you have to be able to identify these value companies in their earlier stages, where even though they are expensive, their growth rate is fast enough to justify a higher valuation. Whereas an Apple today, which is not growing as rapidly as it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago, at some point, if it starts trading at a ridiculous value, then the stock will underperform despite, and I'm not talking just about Apple, just any company for that matter. So what they provide to society matters, but at the same time, valuations also matter. It's just the context in which you're looking at the two.
All right, that's a wrap for our first show of the year. Welcome to 2022. If you want to hear more of the Tom Dupree Show, you can always go to our website, dupreefinancial.com, under the blog and radio tab. Also, we always would love to hear from you, so give us a call, 859-233-0400, for a fresh look at your portfolio for 2022. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the Tom Dupree Show. We'll talk to you next week.